clasps on his wrists, ankles, clamping him into the shadow. A hand takes off his wristwatch, wanted from Scanlan, drops it near the panel. It springs open, cogs and wheels in the long dribbling spiral of spring jumping against the side of the panel and sticking fast. He don't look a bit scared. He keeps grinning at me. They put the graphite salve on his temples.
"What is it?"
he says.
"Conductant," the technician says.
"Anointest my head with conductant. Do I get a crown of thorns?"
They smear it on. He's singing to them, makes their hands shake.
"Get wild root cream oil, Charlie."
Put on those things like headphones, crown of silver thorns over the graphite at his temples. They try to hush his singing with a piece of rubber hose for him to bite on.
"Wage with Hulan Lanolin."
Twist some dials, and the machine trembles. Two robot arms pick up soldering irons and hunch down on him. He gives me the wink and speaks to me, muffled, tells me something, says something to me around that rubber hose just as those irons get close enough to the silver on his temples. Light arcs across, stiffens him, bridges him up off the table till nothing is down but his wrists and ankles, and out around that crimped black rubber hose a sound like hoo-wee, and he's frosted over completely with sparks. And out the window the sparrows drop smoking off the wire. They roll him out on a gurney, still jerking, face frosted white, corrosion, battery acid. The technician turns to me. "Watch that other moose. I know him. Hold him. It's not a willpower thing anymore. Hold him. Damn. No more of these boys without second all." The clamps bite my wrists and ankles. The graphite salve has iron filings in it, temples scratching. He said something when he winked, told me something. Man bends over, brings two irons toward the ring on my head. The machine hunches on me. Air raid. Hit at a lope, running already down the slope. Can't get back, can't go ahead. Look down the barrel and you dead, dead, dead. We come up out of the bull reeds run beside the railroad track. I lay an ear to the track, and it burns my cheek. "Nothing either way," I say. "100 miles. "Hump," Papa says. "Didn't we used to listen for buffalo sticking a knife in the ground, catch the handle in our teeth, hear a herd way off?" "Hump," he says again. But he's tickled. Out across the other side of the track, a fence row of wheat chats from last winter. "Mice under that stuff," the dog says.
"Do we go up the track or down the track, boy?"
"We go across," is what the old dog says.
"That dog don't heal."
"He'll do. There's birds over there," is what the old dog says. "Better hunting up the track bank," is what your old man says.
"Best right across on the chats of wheat," the dog tells me.
Across. Next thing I know, there's people all over the track, blasting away at pheasants like anything. Seems our dog got too far out ahead and run all the birds out of the chats to the track. Dog got 3 mice.
Man, 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 man. Broad and big with a wink like a star. Ants again. Oh, Jesus. And I got them bad this time. Prickle-footed bastards. Remember the time we found those ants tasted like dill pickles? He? You said it wasn't dill pickles, and I said it was. And your mama kicked the living tar out of me when she heard teaching a kid to eat bugs. Ugh! Good Injun boy should know how to survive on anything he can eat that won't eat him first. We ain't Indians. We're civilized, and you remember it. You told me, Papa, when I die, pin me up against the sky. Mama's name was Bromden. Still is Bromden. Papa said he was born with only one name, born smack into it, the way a calf drops out in a spread blanket when the cow insists on standing up. Tiamilatuna. The pine that stands tallest on the mountain, and I'm the biggest, by God, Injun in the state of Oregon, and probably California and Idaho, born right into it. You're the biggest, by God, fool if you think that a good Christian woman takes on a name like Tiamilatuna. You were born into a name, so okay, I'm born into a name. Bromden. Mary Louise Bromden. And when we move into town, Papa says, that name makes getting that Social Security card a lot easier. Guys after somebody with a riveter's hammer get him too if he keeps at it. I see those lightning flashes again,
colors striking.
Ting. Tingle, tingle, tremble, toes. She's a good fisherman, catches hens, puts them in a pens. Wire, blyer, limber lock, three geese in a flock. One flew east, one flew west, one flew over the cuckoo's nest. O-U-T spells out. Goose swoops down and plucks you out. My old grandma chanted this, a game we played by the hours, sitting by the fish rack scaring flies. A game called Tingle Tingle Tangle Toes. Counting each finger on my two outspread hands, one finger to a syllable as she chants. Tingle, tingle, tangle toes, seven fingers. She's a good fisherman, catches hens. 16 fingers, tapping a finger on each beat with her black crab hand, each of my fingernails looking up at her like a little face asking to be the you that the goose swoops down and plucks out. I like the game, and I like Grandma. I don't like Mrs. Tingle Tangle Toes catching hens. I don't like her. I do like that goose flying over the cuckoo's nest. I like him, and I like Grandma, dust in her wrinkles. Next time I saw her, she was stone-cold dead, right in the middle of the dalles on the sidewalk, colored shirts standing around, some Indians, some cattlemen, some wheatmen. They cart her down to the city burying ground, roll red clay into her eyes. I remember hot, still, electric storm afternoons when jackrabbits ran under diesel truck wheels. Joey Fish in a Barrel has $20,000 and three Cadillacs since the contract, and he can't drive none of them. I see a dice. I see it from the inside, me at the bottom. I'm the weight, loading the dice to throw that number one up there above me. They got the dice loaded to throw a snake eyes, and I'm the load. Six lumps around me like white pillows is the other side of the dice, the number six that will always be down when he throws. What's the other dice loaded for? I bet it's loaded to throw one, too. Snake eyes. They're shooting with crookies against him, and I'm the load. Look out. Here comes a toss. Aye, lady, the smokehouse is empty and the baby needs a new pair of opera pumps. Coming at ya. Thaw. Crapped out. Water. I'm lying in a puddle. Snake eyes. Caught him again. I see that number one up above me. He can't whip frozen dice behind the feed store in an alley in Portland. The alley is a tunnel. It's cold because the sun is late afternoon. Let me go see Grandma. Please, Mama. What was it he said when he winked? One flew east, one flew west. Don't stand in my way. Damn it, nurse, don't stand in my way, way, way. My role. Thaw. Damn. Twisted again. Snake eyes. The school teacher tell me you got a good head, boy. Be something. Be what, Papa? A rug weaver like Uncle R and J Wolf? A basket weaver? Or another drunken Indian? I say, attendant, you're an Indian, aren't you? Yeah, that's right. Well, I must say you speak the language quite well. Yeah. Well, $3 of regular. They wouldn't be so cocky if they knew what me and the moon have going. No damned regular Indian. He who... what was it? Walks out of step. Here's another drum. Snake eyes again. Ooh, boy, these dice are cold. After Grandma's funeral, me and Papa and Uncle Running and Jumping Wolf dug her up. Mama wouldn't go with us. She never heard of such a thing, hanging a corpse in a tree. It's enough to make a person sick. Uncle R and J Wolf and Papa spent 20 days in the drunk tank at the Dalles jail playing rummy for violation of the dead. But she's our goddang mother. It doesn't make the slightest difference, boys. You should have left her buried. I don't know when you blamed Indians will learn. Now where is she? You'd better tell. Ah, go fuck yourself, pale face, Uncle R and J said, rolling himself a cigarette. I'll never tell. High, high, high in the hills, high in a pine tree bed. She's tracing the wind with that old hand, counting the clouds with that old chant. Three geese in a flock. What did you say to me when you winked? Band playing. Look, The sky. It's the 4th of July. Dice at rest. They got to me with the machine again. I wonder, what did he say? Wonder how McMurphy made me big again. He said gutsball. They're out there. Black boys in white suits peeing under the door on me. Come in later and accuse me of soaking all six of these pillows I'm lying on. Number 6. I thought the room was a dice. The number 1, the snake eye up there, the circle, the white light in the ceiling, is what I've been seeing. In this little square room. Means it's after dark. How many hours have I been out? It's fogging a little, but I won't slip off and hide in it. No. Never again. I stand, stood up slowly, feeling numb between the shoulders. The white pillows on the floor of the seclusion room were soaked from me peeing on them while I was out. I couldn't remember all of it yet, but I rubbed my eyes with the heels of my hands and tried to clear my head. I worked at it. I'd never worked at coming out of it before. I staggered toward the little round chicken-wired window in the door of the room and tapped it with my knuckles. I saw an aide coming up the hall with a tray for me, and I knew. This time I had them beat. There had been times when I'd wandered around in a daze for as long as 2 weeks after a shock treatment, living in that foggy, jumbled blur, which is a whole lot like the ragged edge of sleep, that gray zone between light and dark, or between sleeping and waking, or living and dying, where you know you're not unconscious anymore, but don't know yet what day it is, or who you are, or what's the use of coming back at all, for 2 weeks. If you don't have a reason to wake up, you can loaf around in that gray zone for a long, fuzzy time, or if you want to bad enough, I found you can come fighting right out of it. This time I came fighting out of it in less than a day, less time than ever. And when the fog was finally swept from my head, it seemed like I'd just come up after a long, deep dive, breaking the surface after being underwater 100 years. It was the last treatment they gave me. They gave McMurphy 3 more treatments that week. As quick as he started coming out of one, getting the click back in his wink, Miss Ratched would arrive with the doctor, and they would ask him if he felt like he was ready to come around and face up to his problem and come back to the ward for a cure. And he'd swell up, aware that every one of those faces undisturbed had turned toward him and was waiting. And he'd tell the nurse he regretted that he had but one life to give for his country, and she could kiss his rosy red ass before he'd give up the goddamn ship. Yeah. Then stand up and take a couple of bows to those guys grinning at him, while the nurse led the doctor into the station to phone over to the main building and authorize another treatment. Once, as she turned to walk away, he got hold of her through the back of her uniform, gave her a pinch that turned her face as red as his hair. I think if the doctor hadn't been there, hiding a grin himself, she would have slapped McMurphy's face. I tried to talk him into playing along with her so as to get out of the treatments, but he just laughed and told me, hell, all they was doing was charging his battery for him, free for nothing. When I get out of here, the first woman that takes on old Red McMurphy, the 10,000-watt psychopath, she's gonna light up like a pinball machine and pay off in silver dollars. Nah, I ain't scared of their little battery charger. He insisted it wasn't hurting him. He wouldn't even take his capsules. But every time that loudspeaker called for him to forego breakfast and prepare to walk to Building 1, the muscles in his jaw went taut and his whole face drained of color, looking thin and scared. The face I had seen reflected in the windshield on the trip back from the coast. I left disturbed at the end of the week and went back to the ward. I had a lot of things I wanted to say to him before I went, but he'd just come back from a treatment and was sitting following the ping-pong ball with his eyes like he was wired to it. The colored aide and the blonde one took me downstairs and let me onto our ward and locked the door behind me. The ward seemed awful quiet after disturbed. I walked to our day room and for some reason stopped at the door. Everybody's face turned up to me with a different look than they'd ever given me before.
Their faces lighted up as if they were looking into the glare of a sideshow platform.
"Here, in front of your very eyes," Harding spiels, "is the wild man who broke the arm of the black boy. Hey-ya, looky, looky."
I grinned back at them, realizing how McMurphy must have felt these months, with these faces screaming up at him. All the guys came over and wanted me to tell them everything that had happened. How was he acting up there? What was he doing? Was it true, what was being rumored over at the gym, that they'd been hitting him every day with EST, and he was shrugging it off like water, making book with the technicians on how long he could keep his eyes open after the poles touched? I told them all I could, and nobody seemed to think a thing about me all of a sudden talking with people. A guy who'd been considered deaf and dumb as far back as they'd known him, talking, listening, just like anybody. I told them everything that they'd heard was true, and tossed in a few stories of my own. They laughed so hard about some of the things he'd said to the nurse that the two vegetables under their wet sheets on the chronic side grinned and snorted along with the laughter, just like they understood. When the nurse herself brought the problem of patient McMurphy up in group the next day, said that for some unusual reason, he did not seem to be responding to EST at all, and that more drastic means might be required to make contact with him, Harding said, "Now, that is possible, Miss Ratchet, yes. But from what I hear about your dealings upstairs with McMurphy, he hasn't had any difficulty making contact with you." She was thrown off balance and flustered so bad with everybody in the room laughing at her that she didn't bring it up again. She saw that McMurphy was growing bigger than ever while he was upstairs where the guys couldn't see the dent she was making on him, growing almost into a legend. A man out of sight can't be made to look weak, she decided, and started making plans to bring him back down to our ward. She figured the guys could see for themselves then that he could be as vulnerable as the next man. He couldn't continue in his hero role if he was sitting around the day room all the time in a shock stupor. The guys anticipated this, and that as long as he was on the ward for them to see, she would be giving him shock every time he came out of it. So Harding and Scanlon and Fredrickson and I talked over how we could convince him that the best thing for everybody concerned would be his escaping the ward. And by the Saturday, when he was brought back to the ward, footworking into the day room like a boxer into a ring, clasping his hands over his head and announcing the champ was back, we had our plan all worked out. We'd wait until dark, set a mattress on fire, and when the firemen came, we'd rush him out the door. It seemed such a fine plan, we couldn't see how he could refuse. But we didn't think about it being the day he'd made a date to have the girl Candy sneak onto the ward for Billy. They brought him back to the ward about 10 in the morning.
"Full of piss and vinegar, buddies. They checked my plugs and cleaned my points, and I got a glow on like a Model T spark coil. Ever use one of those coils around Halloween time? Zam! Good clean fun."
And he batted around the ward bigger than ever, spilled a bucket of mop water under the nurse's station door, laid a pat of butter square on the toe of the least black boy's white suede shoes without the black boy noticing, and smothered giggles all through lunch while it melted to show a color Harding referred to as a most suggestive yellow. Bigger than ever, and each time he brushed close by a student nurse, she gave a yip and rolled her eyes and pitter-patted off down the hall, rubbing her flank. We told him of our plan for his escape, and he told us there was no hurry and reminded us of Billy's date.
"We can't disappoint Billy boy, can we, buddies? Not when he's about to cash in his cherry. And it should be a nice little party tonight if we can pull it off. Let's say maybe it's my going-away party."
It was the big nurse's weekend to work. She didn't want to miss his return. And she decided we'd better have us a meeting to get something settled. At the meeting, she tried once more to bring up her suggestion for a more drastic measure, insisting that the doctor consider such action before it is too late to help the patient. But McMurphy was such a whirligig of winks and yawns and belches while she talked, she finally hushed. And when she did, he gave the doctor and all the patients fits by agreeing with everything she said.
"You know, she might be right, Doc. Look at the good that few measly volts have done me. Maybe if we doubled the charge, I could pick up Channel 8 like Martini. I'm tired of laying in bed hallucinating nothing but Channel 4 with news and weather."
The nurse cleared her throat, trying to regain control of her meeting. "I wasn't suggesting that we consider more shock, Mr. McMurphy."
"Ma'am, I was suggesting
that we consider an operation. Very simple, really. And we've had a history of past successes, eliminating aggressive tendencies in certain hostile cases.
Hostile? Ma'am, I'm friendly as a pup. I haven't kicked the tar out of an aide in nearly 2 weeks. There's been no cause to do any cutting now, has there?
She held out her smile, begging him to see how sympathetic she was. Randall, there's no cutting involved.
Besides, he went on, it wouldn't be any use to lop them off. I got another pair in my nightstand.
Another pair?
One about as big as a baseball, Doc.
Mr. McMurphy. Her smile broke like glass when she realized she was being made fun of.
But the other one is big enough to be considered normal.
He went on like this clear up to the time we were ready for bed. By then there was a festive county fair feeling on the ward, as the men whispered of the possibility of having a party if the girl came with drinks. All the guys were trying to catch Billy's eye, and grinning and winking at him every time he looked. And when we lined up for medication, McMurphy came by and asked the little nurse with the crucifix and the birthmark if he could have a couple of vitamins. She looked surprised and said she didn't see that there was any reason why not and gave him some pills the size of birds' eggs. He put them in his pocket.
Aren't you going to swallow them? She asked.
Me? Lord, no, I don't need vitamins. I was just getting them for Billy Boy here. He seems to me to have a peaked look of late. Tired blood, most likely.
Then why don't you give them to Billy?
I will, honey, I will, but I thought I'd wait till about midnight when he'd have the most need for him.
And walked to the dorm with his arm crooked around Billy's flushing neck, giving Harding a wink and me a goose in the side with his big thumb as he passed us, and left that nurse, pop-eyed behind him in the nurse's station, pouring water on her foot. You have to know about Billy Bibbit. In spite of him having wrinkles in his face and specks of gray in his hair, he still looked like a kid. Like a jug-eared and freckle-faced and buck-toothed kid, whistling barefoot across one of those calendars, with a string of bullheads dragging behind him in the dust. And yet he was nothing like this. You were always surprised to find when he stood up next to one of the other men, he was just as tall as anyone, and that he wasn't jug-eared or freckled or buck-toothed at all under a closer look, and was, in fact, 30-some years old. I heard him give his age only one time, overheard him to tell the truth, when he was talking to his mother down in the lobby. She was receptionist down there, a solid, well-packed lady with hair revolving from blonde to blue to black and back to blonde again every few months, a neighbor of the big nurses, from what I'd heard, and a dear personal friend. Whenever we'd go on some activity, Billy would always be obliged to stop and lean a scarlet cheek over that desk for her to dab a kiss on. It embarrassed the rest of us as much as it did Billy, and for that reason, nobody ever teased him about it. Not even McMurphy. One afternoon, I don't recall how long back, we stopped on our way to activities and sat around the lobby on the big plastic sofas or outside in the 2 o'clock sun while one of the black boys used the phone to call his bookmaker, and Billy's mother took the opportunity to leave her work and come out from behind her desk and take her boy by the hand and lead him outside to sit near where I was on the grass. She sat stiff there on the grass, tight at the bend, with her short round legs out in front of her in stockings, reminding me of the color of bologna skins. And Billy lay beside her and put his head in her lap and let her tease at his ear with a dandelion fluff. Billy was talking about looking for a wife and going to college someday. His mother tickled him with the fluff and laughed at such foolishness. Sweetheart, you still have scads of time for things like that. Your whole life is ahead of you.
Mother, I'm 31 years old.
She laughed and twiddled his ear with the weed.
Sweetheart, do I look like the mother of a middle-aged man?
She wrinkled her nose and opened her lips at him and made a kind of wet kissing sound in the air with her tongue, and I had to admit she didn't look like a mother of any kind. I didn't believe myself that he could be 31 years old. Till later when I edged up close enough to get a look at the birth date on his wristband. At midnight, when Giver and the other black boy and the nurse went off duty, and the poor old colored fellow Mr. Turkle came on for his shift, McMurphy and Billy were already up, taking vitamins, I imagined. I got out of bed and put on a robe and walked out to the day room, where they were talking with Mr. Turkle. Harding and Scanlon and Seafelt and some of the other guys came out too. McMurphy was telling Mr. Turkle what to expect if the girl did come, reminding him, actually, because it looked like they'd talked it all over beforehand a couple of weeks back. McMurphy said that the thing to do was let the girl in the window, instead of risking having her come through the lobby, where the night supervisor might be. And to unlock the seclusion room, then. Yeah, won't that make a fine honeymoon shack for the lovers? Mighty secluded.
McMurphy,
Billy kept trying to say. And to keep the lights out, so the supervisor couldn't see in, and close the dorm doors and not wake up every slobbering chronic in the place, and to keep quiet. We don't want to disturb them.
Ah, come on, Mac,
Billy said. Mr. Turkle kept nodding and bobbing his head, appearing to fall half asleep. When McMurphy said, I guess that pretty well covers things, Mr. Turkle said,
No, not entirely,
and sat there grinning in his white suit with his bald yellow head floating at the end of his neck like a balloon on a stick.
Come on, Turkle. It'll be worth your while. She should be bringing a couple of bottles.
You getting closer, Mr. Turkle said.
His head lolled and bobbled. He was acting like he was barely able to keep awake. I'd heard he worked another job during the day at a racetrack. McMurphy turned to Billy.
Turkle is holding out for a bigger contract, Billy boy. How much is it worth to you to lose your old cherry?
Before Billy could stop stuttering and answer, Mr. Turkle shook his head.
It ain't that, not money. She bringing more than a bottle with her, though, ain't she, this sweet thing? You people be sharing more in a bottle, won't you?
He grinned around at the faces. Billy nearly burst, trying to stutter something about not candy, not his girl. McMurphy took him aside and told him not to worry about his girl's chastity. Turkle would likely be so drunk and sleepy by the time Billy was finished that the old coon couldn't put a carrot in a washtub. The girl was late again. We sat out in the day room in our robes, listening to McMurphy and Mr. Turkle tell army stories, while they passed one of Mr. Turkle's cigarettes back and forth, smoking in a funny way, holding the smoke in when they inhaled till their eyes bugged. Once Harding asked what manner of cigarette they were smoking that smelled so provocative, and Mr. Turkle said in a high, breath-holding voice,
Just a plain old cigarette. Yes, you want a toke?
Billy got more and more nervous, afraid the girl might not show up, afraid she might. He kept asking why we didn't all go to bed instead of sitting out here in the cold dark like hounds waiting at the kitchen table for scraps, and we just grinned at him. None of us felt like going to bed. It wasn't cold at all, and it was pleasant to relax in the half-light and listen to McMurphy and Mr. Turkle tell tales. Nobody acted sleepy or not even worried that it was after 2 o'clock and the girl hadn't showed up yet. Turkle suggested maybe she was late because the ward was so dark and she couldn't see to tell which one to come to. And McMurphy said that that was the obvious truth, so the two of them ran up and down the halls, turning on every light in the place. We're even about to turn on the big overhead wake-up lights in the dorm, when Harding told them this would just get all the other men out of bed to share things with. They agreed, and settled for all the lights in the doctor's office instead. No sooner did they have the ward lit up like full daylight, then there came a tapping at the window. McMurphy ran to the window and put his face to it, cupping his hands on each side so he could see. He drew back and grinned at us.
She walks like beauty in the night, he said.
He took Billy by the wrist and dragged him to the window.
Let her in, Turkle. Let this mad stud at her.
Look, McMurphy, wait.
Billy was balking like a mule.
Don't you Murphy me, Billy boy. It's too late to back out now. You'll pull through. I'll tell you what, I got $5 here says you burned that woman down, all right? Open the window, Turkle.
There were two girls in the dark, Candy and the other one that hadn't shown up for the fishing trip.
Hot dog, Turkle said, helping them through. Enough for everybody.
We all went to help. They had to lift their tight skirts up to their thighs to step through the window. Candy said,
You damn McMurphy,
and tried so wild to throw her arms around him that she came near to breaking the bottle she held by the neck in each hand. She was weaving around quite a bit, and her hair was falling out of the hairdo she had piled on top of her head. I thought she looked better with it swung at the back like she'd worn it on the fishing trip. She gestured at the other girl with a bottle as she came through the window.
Sandy came along. She just up and left that maniac from Beaverton that she married. Isn't that wild?
The girl came through the window and kissed McMurphy and said,
Hello, Mac. I'm sorry I didn't show up, but that's over. You can take just so many funsies like white mice in your pillowcase and worms in your cold cream and frogs in your bra.
She shook her head once and wiped her hand in front of her like she was wiping away the memory of her animal-loving husband.
Jesus, what a maniac.
They were both in skirts and sweaters and nylons and barefoot and both red-cheeked and giggling.
We had to keep asking for directions,
Candy explained,
at every bar we came to.
Sandy was turning around in a big wide-eyed circle.
Woo-wee, Candy Girl, what are we in now? Is this real? Are we in an asylum? Man!
She was bigger than Candy, and maybe 5 years older, and had tried to lock her bay-colored hair in a stylish bun at the back of her head, but it kept stringing down around her broad, milk-fed cheekbones, and she looked like a cowgirl trying to pass herself off as a society lady. Her shoulders and breasts and hips were too wide and her grin too big and open for her to ever be called beautiful. But she was pretty, and she was healthy, and she had one big long finger crooked in the ring of a gallon of red wine, and it swung at her side like a purse.
How, Candy? how do these wild things happen to us?
She turned around once more and stopped, with her bare feet spread, giggling. These things don't happen, Harding said to the girl solemnly. These things are fantasies you lie awake at night dreaming up, and then are afraid to tell your analyst. You're not really here. That wine isn't real. None of this exists. Now, let's go on from there.
Hello, Billy, Candy said.
Look at that stuff, Turkle said.
Candy straight-armed one of the bottles awkwardly toward Billy.
I brought you a present.
These things are Thorn-Smithian daydreams, Harding said.
Boy, the girl named Sandy said, what have we got ourselves into?
Shh, Scanlan said, and scowled around him. You'll wake up those other bastards talking so loud.
What's the matter, Stingy?
Sandy giggled, starting to turn in her circle again.
You're scared there's not enough to go around?
Sandy, I might have known you'd bring that damn cheap port.
Boy!
She stopped her turning to look up at me.
Dig this one, Candy! A Goliath! Fee-fi-fo-fum!
Mr. Turkle said,
Hot dog!
And locked the screen back, and Sandy said, Boy! Again. We were all in an awkward little cluster in the middle of the day room, shifting around one another, saying things just because nobody knew what else to do yet, never been up against a situation like it. And I don't know when this excited, uneasy flurry of talk and giggling and shuffling around the day room would have stopped if that ward door hadn't rung with a key, knocking it open down the hall, jarred everybody like a burglar alarm going off.
Oh, Lord God,
Mr. Turkle said, clapping his hand on top of his bald head.
It's the supervisor come to fire my black ass.
We all ran into the latrine and turned out the light and stood in the dark listening to one another breathe. We could hear that supervisor wander around the ward, calling for Mr. Turkle in a loud, half-afraid whisper. Her voice was soft and worried, rising at the end as she called,
Mr. Turkle? Mr. Turkle?
Where the hell is he?
McMurphy whispered.
Why don't he answer her?
Don't worry, Scanlan said. She won't look in the can.
But why don't he answer? Maybe he got too high.
Man, what you talking? I don't get too high, not on a little middling joint like that one.
It was Mr. Turkle's voice, somewhere in the dark latrine with us.
Jesus, Turkle, what are you doing in here?
McMurphy was trying to sound stern and keep from laughing at the same time.
Get out there and see what she wants. What'll she think if she doesn't find you?
The end is upon us, Harding said and sat down. Allah be merciful.
Turkle opened the door and slipped out and met her in the hall. She'd come over to see what all the lights were on about, what made it necessary to turn on every fixture in the ward. Turkle said every fixture wasn't on,
that the dorm lights were off and so were the ones in the latrine. She said that was no excuse for the other lights. What possible reason could there be for all this light? Turkle couldn't come up with an answer for this, and during the long pause I heard the bottle being passed around near me in the dark. Out in the hall she asked him again, and Turkle told her, well, he was just cleaning up, policing the areas. She wanted to know why, then, was the latrine, the place that his job description called for him to have clean, the only place that was dark. And the bottle went around again while we waited to see what he'd answer. It came by me, and I took a drink. I felt I needed it. I could hear Turkle swallowing all the way out in the hall, umming and aahing for something to say.
"He's sculled,"
McMurphy hissed.
"Somebody's gonna have to go out and help him."
I heard a toilet flush behind me, and the door opened, and Harding was caught in the hall light as he went out, pulling up his pajamas. I heard the supervisor gasp at the sight of him, and he told her to pardon him, but he hadn't seen her, being as it was so dark.
"It isn't dark. In the latrine, I meant. I always switch off the lights to achieve a better bowel movement. Those mirrors, you understand. When the light is on, the mirrors seem to be sitting in judgment over me to arbitrate a punishment if everything doesn't come out right. But Aide Turkle said he was cleaning in there. And doing quite a good job, too, I might add, considering the restrictions imposed on him by the dark. Would you care to see?"
Harding pushed the door open a crack, and a slice of light cut across the latrine floor tile. I caught a glimpse of the supervisor backing off, saying she'd have to decline his offer, but she had further rounds to make. I heard the ward door unlock again up the hall, and she let herself off the ward. Harding called to her to return soon for another visit, and everybody rushed out and shook his hand and pounded his back for the way he'd pulled it off. We stood there in the hall, and the wine went around again. Seafelt said he'd as leave have that vodka if there was something to mix it with. He asked Mr. Turkle if there wasn't something on the ward to put in it, and Turkle said nothing but water. Fredrickson asked what about the cough syrup.
"They give me a little now and then from a half-gallon jug in the drug room. It's not bad tasting. You have a key for that room, Turkle?"
Turkle said the supervisor was the only one on nights who had a key to the drug room, but McMurphy talked him into letting us have a try at picking the lock. Turkle grinned and nodded his head lazily. While he and McMurphy worked on the lock on the drug room with paper clips, the girls and the rest of us ran around in the nurse's station, opening files and reading records.
"Look here," Scanlon said, waving one of those folders. "Talk about complete. They've even got my first grade report card in here. Ah, miserable grades. Just miserable."
Bill and his girl were going over his folder. She stepped back to look him over.
"All these things, Billy? Fennec this and Pathic that? You don't look like you have all these things."
The other girl had opened a supply drawer and was suspicious about what the nurses needed with all those hot water bottles, a million of them, and Harding was sitting on the big nurse's desk, shaking his head at the whole affair. McMurphy and Turkle got the door of the drug room open and brought out a bottle of thick cherry-colored liquid from the icebox. McMurphy tipped the bottle to the light and read the label out loud.
"Artificial flavor, coloring, citric acid, 70% inert materials, that must be water, and 20% alcohol, that's fine, and 10% codeine, warning, narcotic may be habit-forming."
He unscrewed the bottle and took a taste of it, closing his eyes. He worked his tongue around his teeth and took another swallow and read the label again.
"Well,"
he said, and clicked his teeth together like they'd just been sharpened.
"If we cut it a little bit with the vodka, I think it'll be all right. How are we fixed for ice cubes, Turkey, old buddy?"
Mixed in paper medicine cups with the liquor and the port wine, the syrup had a taste like a kid's drink, but a punch like the cactus apple wine we used to get in the Dalles, cold and soothing on the throat, and hot and furious once it got down. We turned out the lights in the day room and sat around drinking it. We threw the first couple of cups down like we were taking our medication, drinking it in serious and silent doses, and looking one another over to see if it was going to kill anybody. McMurphy and Turkle switched back and forth from the drink to Turkle's cigarettes and got to giggling again as they discussed how it would be to lay that little nurse with the birthmark who went off at midnight.
I'd be scared, Turkle said, that she might go to whooping me with that big old cross on that chain. Won't that be a fix to be in now?
I'd be scared, McMurphy said,
that just about the time I was getting my jolly, she'd reach around behind me with a thermometer and take my temperature.
That busted everybody up. Harding stopped laughing long enough to join the joking.
Or worse yet, he said, just lie there under you with a dreadful concentration on her face and tell you, oh, Jesus, listen, tell you what your pulse was.
Oh, don't, oh, my God.
Or even worse, just lie there and be able to calculate your pulse and temperature both sans instruments.
Oh, God, oh, please don't.
We laughed till we were rolling about the couches and chairs, choking and teary-eyed. The girls were so weak from laughing that they had to try two or three times to get to their feet.
I gotta go tinkle,
the big one said, and went weaving and giggling toward the latrine and missed the door, staggered into the dorm while we all hushed one another with fingers to the lips, waiting till she gave a squeal and we heard old Colonel Matterson roar,
"The pillow is a horse,"
and come whisking out of the dorm right behind her in his wheelchair. Seafelt wheeled the colonel back to the dorm and showed the girl where the latrine was personally, told her it was generally used by males only, but he would stand at the door while she was in there and guard against intrusions on her privacy, defended against all comers, by gosh. She thanked him solemnly and shook his hand, and they saluted each other, and while she was inside, here came the colonel out of the dorm in his wheelchair again, and Seafelt had his hands full keeping him out of the latrine. When the girl came out of the door, he was trying to ward off the charges of the wheelchair with his foot, while we stood on the edge of the fracas cheering one guy or the other. The girl helped Seafelt put the colonel back to bed, and then the two of them went down the hall and waltzed to music nobody could hear. Harding drank and watched and shook his head.
It isn't happening. It's all a collaboration of Kafka and Mark Twain and Martini.
McMurphy and Turkle got to worrying that there might still be too many lights, so they went up and down the hall, turning out everything that glowed, even the little knee-high night lights, till the place was pitch black. Turkle got out flashlights, and we played tag up and down the hall with wheelchairs from storage, having a big time till we heard one of Seafelt's convulsion cries and went to find him sprawled, twitching beside that big girl, Sandy. She was sitting on the floor, brushing at her skirt, looking down at Seafelt.
I never experienced anything like it, she said with quiet awe.
Fredrickson knelt beside his friend and put a wallet between his teeth to keep him from chewing his tongue and helped him get his pants buttoned.
You all right, Seaf? Seaf?
Seafelt didn't open his eyes, but he raised a limp hand and picked the wallet out of his mouth. He grinned through his spit.
I'm all right,
he said.
Medicate me. And turn me loose again.
You really need some medication, Seaf.
Medication.
Medication, Fredrickson said over his shoulder, still kneeling. Medication, Harding repeated, and weaved off with his flashlight to the drug room. Sandy watched him go with glazed eyes. She was sitting beside Seafelt, stroking his head in wonderment.
Maybe you better bring me something, too,
she called drunkenly after Harding.
I never experienced anything to come even close to it.
Down the hall we heard glass crash, and Harding came back with a double handful of pills, sprinkled them over Seafelt and the woman like he was crumbling clods into a grave. He raised his eyes toward the ceiling.
Most merciful God, accept these two poor sinners into your arms, and keep the doors ajar for the coming of the rest of us, because you are witnessing the end. The absolute, irrevocable, fantastic end. I've finally realized what is happening. It is our last fling. We are doomed henceforth. Must screw our courage to the sticking point and face up to our impending fate. We shall be all of us shot at dawn. 100 cc's apiece. Miss Ratchet shall line us all against the wall, where we'll face the terrible maw of a muzzle-loading shotgun which she has loaded with Miltones, Thorazines, Libriums, Stelazines, and with a wave of her sword, Bluey, tranquilize all of us completely out of existence.
He sagged against the wall and slid to the floor, pills hopping out of his hands in all directions like red and green and orange bugs.
Amen, he said,
and closed his eyes. The girl on the floor smoothed down her skirt over her long, hard-working legs and looked at Seafelt grinning and twitching there under the lights beside her and said,
Never in my life experienced anything to come even halfway near it.
Harding's speech, if it hadn't actually sobered people, had at least made them realize the seriousness of what we were doing. The night was getting on, and some thought had to be given to the arrival of the staff in the morning. Billy Bibbit and his girl mentioned that it was after 4 o'clock, and if it was all right, if people didn't mind, they'd like to have Mr. Turkle unlock the seclusion room. They went off under an arc of flashlight beams, and the rest of us went into the day room to see what we could decide about cleaning up. Turkle was all but passed out when he got back from seclusion, and we had to push him into the day room in a wheelchair. As I walked after them, it came to me as a kind of sudden surprise that I was drunk. Actually drunk. Glowing and grinning and staggering drunk, for the first time since the army. Drunk along with half a dozen other guys and a couple of girls, right on the big nurse's ward. Drunk and running and laughing and carrying on with women square in the center of the Combine's most powerful stronghold. I thought back on the night, on what we'd been doing, and it was near impossible to believe. I had to keep reminding myself that it had truly happened, that we had made it happen. We had just unlocked a window and let it in like you let in the fresh air. Maybe the Combine wasn't all-powerful. What was to stop us from doing it again, now that we saw we could, or keep us from doing other things we wanted? I felt so good thinking about this that I gave a yell and swooped down on McMurphy and the girl Sandy walking along in front of me, grabbed them both up, one in each arm, and ran all the way to the day room with them hollering and kicking like kids. I felt that good. Colonel Matterson got up again, bright-eyed and full of lessons, and Scanlon wheeled him back to bed. Seafelt and Martini and Fredrickson said they'd better hit the sack too. McMurphy and I and Harding and the girl and Mr. Turkle stayed up to finish off the cough syrup and decide what we were going to do about the mess the ward was in. Me and Harding acted like we were the only ones really very worried about it. McMurphy and the big girl just sat there and sipped that syrup and grinned at each other and played hand games in the shadows. And Mr. Turkle kept dropping off to sleep. Harding did his best to try to get them concerned.
All of you fail to comprehend the complexities of the situation, he said.
Bull, McMurphy said.
Harding slapped the table.
McMurphy, Turkle, you fail to realize what has occurred here tonight on a mental ward, Miss Ratchet's ward. The recuperations will be devastating.
McMurphy bit the girl's earlobe. Turkle nodded and opened one eye and said,
That's true. She'll be on tomorrow, too.
I, however, have a plan,
Harding said. He got to his feet. He said McMurphy was obviously too far gone to handle the situation himself, and someone else would have to take over. As he talked, he stood straighter and became more sober. He spoke in an earnest and urgent voice, and his hands shaped what he said. I was glad he was there to take over. His plan was that we were to tie up Turkle and make it look like McMurphy'd snuck up behind him, tied him up with, oh, say, strips of torn sheet, and relieved him of his keys, and after getting the keys had broken into the drug room, scattered drugs around, and raised hell with the files just to spite the nurse. She'd believe that part. Then he'd unlocked the screen and made his escape. McMurphy said it sounded like a television plot, and it was so ridiculous it couldn't help but work, and he complimented Harding on his clear-headedness. Harding said the plan had its merits. It would keep the other guys out of trouble with the nurse, and keep Turkle his job, and get McMurphy off the ward. He said McMurphy could have the girls drive him to Canada or Tijuana, or even Nevada if he wanted, and be completely safe.
The police never press too hard to pick up AWOLs from the hospital, because 90% of them always show back up in a few days, broke and drunk and looking for that free bed and board. We talked about it for a while and finished the cough syrup. We finally talked it to silence. Harding sat back down. McMurphy took his arm from around the girl and looked from me to Harding, thinking, that strange, tired expression on his face again. He asked, what about us? Why didn't we just up and get our clothes on and make it out with him?
I'm not quite ready yet, Mac, Harding told him.
And what makes you think I am?
Harding looked at him in silence for a time and smiled, then said,
no, you don't understand. I'll be ready in a few weeks, but I want to do it on my own, by myself, right out that front door, with all the traditional red tape and complications. I want my wife to be here in a car at a certain time to pick me up. I want them to know I was able to do it that way.
McMurphy nodded.
What about you, Chief?
I figure I'm all right. Just I don't know where I want to go yet. And somebody should stay here a few weeks after you're gone to see that things don't start sliding back.
What about Billy and Seafelt and Fredrickson and the rest?
I can't speak for them, Harding said. They've still got their problems just like all of us. They're still sick men in lots of ways. But at least there's that. They are sick men now. No more rabbits, Mac. Maybe they can be well men someday. I can't say.
McMurphy thought this over, looking at the backs of his hands. He looked back up to Harding.
Harding, what is it? What happens?
You mean all this?
McMurphy nodded. Harding shook his head.
I don't think I can give you an answer. Oh, I could give you Freudian reasons with fancy talk, and that would be right as far as it went. But what you want are the reasons for the reasons, and I'm not able to give you those. Not for the others, anyway. For myself, guilt, shame, fear, self-belittlement. I discovered at an early age that I was, shall we be kind and say, different. It's a better, more general word than the other one. I indulged in certain practices that our society regards as shameful, and I got sick. It wasn't the practices, I don't think. It was the feeling that the great, deadly, pointing forefinger of society was pointing at me, and the great voice of millions chanting, shame. 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 It's society's way of dealing with someone different.
I'm different, McMurphy said. Why didn't something like that happen to me? I've had people bugging me about one thing or another as far back as I can remember, but that's not what... But it didn't drive me crazy.
No, you're right. That's not what drove you crazy. I wasn't giving my reason as the sole reason. Though I used to think at one time, a few years ago, my turtleneck years, that society's chastising was the sole force that drove one along the road to crazy. But you've caused me to reappraise my theory. There's something else that drives people, strong people like you, my friend, down that road.
Yeah? Not that I'm admitting I'm down that road, but what is this something else?
It is us.
He swept his hand about him in a soft white circle and repeated,
us.
McMurphy half-heartedly said,
bull,
and grinned and stood up, pulling the girl to her feet. He squinted up at the dim clock.
It's nearly 5. I need me a little shut-eye before my big getaway. The day shift doesn't come on for another 2 hours yet. Let's leave Billy and Candy down there a while longer. I'll cut out about 6.
Sandy, honey, maybe an hour in the dorm would sober us up. What do you say? We got a long drive tomorrow, whether it's Canada or Mexico or wherever.
Turkle and Harding and I stood up too. Everybody was still weaving pretty much, still pretty drunk. But a mellow, sad feeling had drifted over the drunk. Turkle said he'd boot McMurphy and the girl out of bed in an hour.
"Wake me up too," Harding said. "I'd like to stand there at the window with a silver bullet in my hand and ask, who was that masked man as you ride?"
"The hell with that. You guys both get in bed. I don't want to ever see hide nor hair of you again. You get me?" Harding grinned and nodded, but he didn't say anything. McMurphy put his hand out, and Harding shook it. McMurphy tipped back like a cowboy reeling out of a saloon and winked.
"You can be Bull Goose Looney again, buddy. What with Big Mac out of the way?"
He turned to me and frowned.
"I don't know what you can be, Chief. You still got some looking to do. Maybe you could get your job being a bad guy on TV wrestling. Anyway, take her easy."
I shook his hand, and we all started for the dorm. McMurphy told Turkle to tear up some sheets and pick out some of his favorite knots to be tied with. Turkle said he would. I got into my bed in the graying light of the dorm and heard McMurphy and the girl get into his bed. I was feeling numb and warm. I heard Mr. Turkle open the door to the linen room out in the hall, heave a long, loud, belching sigh as he pulled the door closed behind him. My eyes got used to the dark, and I could see McMurphy and the girl snuggled into each other's shoulders, getting comfortable. More like two tired little kids than a grown man and a grown woman in bed together to make love. And that's the way the black boys found them when they came to turn on the dorm lights at 6:30. I've given what happened next a good lot of thought, and I've come around to thinking that it was bound to be, and would have happened in one way or another, at this time or that, even if Mr. Turkle had got McMurphy and the two girls up and off the ward like was planned. The big nurse would have found out some way what had gone on, maybe just by the look on Billy's face, and she'd have done the same as she did whether McMurphy was still around or not. And Billy would have done what he did, and McMurphy would have heard about it and come back, would have had to come back, because he could no more have sat around outside the hospital playing poker in Carson City or Reno or someplace and let the big nurse have the last move and get the last play than he could have let her get by with it right under his nose. It was like he'd signed on for the whole game, and there wasn't any way of him breaking his contract. As soon as we started getting out of bed and circulating around the ward, the story of what had taken place was spreading in a brush fire of low talk.
"They had a what?"
asked the ones who hadn't been in on it.
"A whore? In the dorm? Jesus!"
Not only a whore, the others told them, but a drunken blast to boot. McMurphy was planning to sneak her out before the day crew came on, but he didn't wake up.
"Now what kind of crock are you giving us?"
"No crock. It's every word gospel. I was in on it." Those who had been in on the night started telling about it with a kind of quiet pride and wonder, the way people tell about seeing a big hotel fire or a dam bursting, very solemn and respectful, because the casualties aren't even counted yet. But the longer the telling went on, the less solemn the fellows got. Every time the big nurse and her hustling black boys turned up something new, such as the empty bottle of cough syrup or the fleet of wheelchairs parked at the end of the hall like empty rides in an amusement park, it brought another part of the night back sudden and clear to be told to the guys who weren't in on it and to be savored by the guys who were. Everybody had been herded into the day room by the black boys, chronics and acutes alike, milling together in excited confusion. The two old vegetables sat sunk in their bedding, snapping their eyes and their gums. Everybody was still in pajamas and slippers, except McMurphy and the girl. She was dressed, except for her shoes and the nylon stockings, which now hung over her shoulder, and he was in his black shorts with the white whales. They were sitting together on a sofa, holding hands. The girl had dozed off again, and McMurphy was leaning against her with a satisfied and sleepy grin. Our solemn worry was giving way, in spite of us, to joy and humor. When the nurse found the pile of pills Harding had sprinkled on Seafelt and the girl, we started to pop and snort to keep from laughing, and by the time they found Mr. Turkle in the linen room and led him out blinking and groaning, tangled in 100 yards of torn sheet like a mummy with a hangover, we were roaring. The big nurse took our good humor without so much as a trace of her little pasted smile. Every laugh was being forced right down her throat, till it looked as if any minute she'd blow up like a bladder. McMurphy draped one bare leg over the edge of the sofa and pulled his cap down to keep the light from hurting his reddened eyes, and he kept licking out a tongue that looked like it had been shellacked by that cough syrup. He looked